I'm going to talk to you about echoes. When waves on a water surface roll up against a wall, they are reflected. We see that happen when the waves on the sea strike a cliff and recoil from it. We may see the same effect on a smaller scale in a tank or a bath or even a teacup. Now, sound is also a form of wave motion and recoils like the water waves when it strikes the boundary of the air which is carrying it. When we make some sound which travels away and eventually returns to us after reflection at some distant cliff or house or wood, we hear the echo, as we call it. We may observe the time that elapses between the utterance of the sound and the return of the echo, and by assuming that sound travels at the rate of 1,100 feet a second, calculate the distance between the reflector and the source of sound. Or we may use the experiment in the reverse way, and knowing the distance of the reflector, use our measurements to find the velocity of sound. There is a cloistered arcade in one of the courts of Trinity College at Cambridge where it is easy to make the experiment. You clap your hands, and after a moment, the echo returns from the blank wall at the distant end. If now you time your claps so that each is simultaneous with the arrival of the reflection from the clap that preceded it, and count how many claps you make in the minute under those conditions, and if further you measure the distance between yourself and the reflecting wall, it is easy to calculate the rate at which sound travels. It always gives us pleasure to hear an echo in the open country. It is strange, no doubt, to hear our words repeated as though someone were mocking us. Good reflections are not so common that we cease to be interested. We all know places where they're to be found and take a certain pride in them if the countryside is our own. Some are famous, of course, for their force and distinctness, like the echo of Killarney. Tyndall describes a beautiful echo in a Swiss valley called the Ochsental, where the sound of the horn is first reflected somewhat roughly, but there's a series of repeated reflections from the rocks nearby, as well as retarded reflections from rocks that are further away. As they continue, they become softer and more flute-like, and the gradual diminution in their intensity gives the impression that the source of sound is retreating further and further into the solitudes of ice and snow. The surface that reflects sound need not be hard and smooth, as in the case of light. A rough wall may reflect exceedingly well, or a rugged cliff, or even a grove of trees, or a line of railings. That is because the sound waves are very much larger or coarser than the waves of light, and little irregularities of the surface do not affect them. The sound that comes back is generally of the same character as the original, though it is weaker, of course. There are, however, curious exceptions. The late Lord Rayleigh, who was greatly interested in the laws of sound, describes an echo which he heard in the ground of Mr. Beresford Hope, whom many will remember. The echo of a woman's voice returned an octave higher than the original. The strange effect seemed to be due to the fact that the sound was reflected by a plantation of firs, and the leaves and boughs of the wood, being small in comparison with the wavelengths of sound, turned back the short waves more than the long waves. In other words, reflected the notes of high pitch more than those of low pitch. The modified echo of which I have just been speaking has an analogy in a certain optical effect. As the sun's rays pass through the air, the short waves of the blue end of the spectrum are turned aside more than the longer red waves by the molecules of the air, and that is why the sky is blue. The light that goes straight on becomes richer and richer in the longer waves, and hence the colors of the rising and setting sun. In the case of Lord Rayleigh's echo, the high-pitched notes corresponding to the short waves of light are returned by the fir trees in greater quantity than the notes of low pitch. Stories have been told of sound echoes which returned in a form so different from the original that the pitch must have actually changed, but these are surely mistaken. The pitch of a note does not alter on reflection. The change which Lord Rayleigh describes is no doubt due, as he suggested, to the excessive reflections of high notes, which were present in addition to the low notes in the speaker's voice. Though the echoes of the open air more often excite our attention, the echoes of closed spaces are far more common and affect us more frequently. They return to us so quickly that we do not distinguish them as separate sounds. We talk instead of an echoing hall or a reverberating room, but we do not always realize that the effect is exactly the same as the echo which we stop to listen to in the country. We come now to a question which has particularly forced itself on our attention in recent years, the question of good hearing in halls intended for public speaking. The principles to be remembered as determining whether a room shall be good or bad are simple and few. In the first place, sound travels at a certain rate, nearly 1,100 feet a second. In the next place, it is reflected by any surface that it meets, more or less. If the surface is fairly even and hard, the sound recoils without losing much of its intensity. Surfaces that are soft and porous do not reflect so well. When the walls, ceiling, and floor are all good reflectors, a sound may ring on for many seconds. We must all have observed this effect in an empty room, and we cannot write of the clang of the dungeon door without mentioning that its clang echoes through the reverberating passages. It's a rough but convenient test of the resonance of a room to clap one's hands and count the seconds till the sound dies away. In a large and very empty room, it may take 6 or 7 seconds. Now, if a sound persists as long as that, good hearing is impossible. The cure for such a fault is to destroy the reflecting powers of the room. If a sound that is made in a room can be heard 5 seconds afterwards, it has travelled more than a mile in its excursions to and fro, and its waves have searched every corner of the room. It has undergone hundreds of reflections. If a soft carpet is put on any part of the floor, or a curtain hung upon the wall, it is sure to have its effect, because the sound will have come that way many times in the course of its travels to and fro, and will be weakened at each such reflection. With the delicate means of observation that have of late years been applied to the examination of this question, the effect of introducing a very few cushions or persons is observable. The cushion and the body both spoil reflection to some extent. Now, if it is possible to close the room until the reverberation period is brought down to 2 seconds or so, the hearing is no longer spoilt by echoes. The acoustics of public buildings have been the subject of much research in recent times, and it has been possible for many years past to predict the resonance of a room that is to be built, and to calculate the amount of draping, carpets or cushions or hangings that will be required to make the room suitable for speaking, or for music, as the case may be. The room in which I am speaking is an example of the reduction of resonance. The floor is covered with soft carpets, the walls are draped, and the resonance is so reduced that those who enter the room for the first time are often struck by the hush that prevails. The object is, of course, to let the microphone have the original sound without any disturbing reflections. Not all the difficulties of hearing in a room are to be classed as due to reverberation. A very simple but serious difficulty can arise from the existence of a single reflecting surface, if it is placed in certain positions. Suppose, for example, that a hall is 60 feet high and that the roof is a good reflector of sound. The sounds of the voice travel up to the roof and return more than 1/10 of a second later, making a distracting duplication of everything said. The roof must be made less reflecting if the defect is to be cured. Much attention is now being given to the use of a kind of porous brick for the interior lining of walls and ceilings. The air waves lose their force in penetrating the tiny cavities, and the change in reflecting power is most striking. A notable example of the occurrence of this problem and of its solution is found in the new legislative chamber at Delhi in India. We can, of course, go to the other extreme. The deadness of this room would be excessive in the case of a large hall, where the carry of the speaker's voice to distant parts is assisted by the reflection of the walls. It's really a matter of compromise. Sometimes a hall has many openings into galleries or recesses, from which if a sound makes its way into them, there's no return. They form the perfect absorber. It may then be impossible for the speaker to reach the extremes of the hall. I believe that the cathedral at Oxford is an example of this kind. A curved surface focuses the sound waves, concentrating sound waves on one point and impoverishing others. Sometimes this also is responsible for imperfect hearing in a hall. It's a very good thing that the question of hearing in public buildings has been recently considered, for it is a grievous pity that so many splendid examples of architecture have been spoilt by a lack of attention to one neglected point. Finally, we must pay a tribute of wonder to the curious idea that stretched wires can have any effect. There must have been a cause for the idea at some time or another, but it's difficult to imagine what it could have been. Now I may mention one or two cases in which the reflection of sound has come as a help and not a difficulty. One of the most curious and interesting is the application to the problem of measuring the depth of the sea. The usual method is, of course, to have the line and its lead sinker, and this method has lasted for centuries. But there are grave difficulties in its use under modern conditions of increased speed. A ship does not care to slow down to the extent that is necessary before a sounding can be taken in the old fashion. Consequently, endeavors have been made to develop a system of determining the depth of water below a ship by the time taken for a sound to reach the bottom of the sea and return as an echo. Since sound travels in water some 5,000 feet a second, the operation requires extraordinary pains, as we may well imagine. The difficulty of this method of which I have been speaking is increased by the fact that the original sound must be loud, or else the echo will not be heard, and yet the listening microphone is liable to be upset completely by any great shock. The difficulty is surmounted in a most ingenious way. A revolving mechanism determines in the first place the time at which a steel plate shall be struck. At the moment of striking, the microphone is out of action and does not hear the sound. At a certain interval, determined by the same mechanism, the telephone is thrown into action for a minute interval of time. If the echo happens to return at that instant, it is heard. But if not, the telephone is unaffected and is kept resting and sensitive. The interval is then varied by a simple contrivance belonging to the mechanism until the echo is heard distinctly, and this interval of time is read off on a dial. The depth of the water is at once known. The results are very good. Charts that have been taken while a ship was underway agree well with those obtained by sounding by the older and time-consuming kind. Another very interesting application of sound reflection is under trial. It may be possible to determine the distance of an iceberg by a similar echo method. The difficulty is very great because ice differs so little from water that reflection at the surface of the berg is only feeble. However, a certain amount of progress has been made. There's a less definite use of sound reflection which is very interesting. As we move about the rooms and passages of a building, we're often conscious of the reflections from our surroundings, which are so immediate that they cannot be separated from their originals, and yet are easily to be perceived. We who have eyes do not make much use of them, and yet we are well aware of them under certain circumstances. At night, if we walk along a passage in the dark, we know almost to a foot when we've come to the door at the end, by hearing only. We know when we pass a curtain or a passage that opens out at right angles. But the blind have learnt to use these countless and varied reflections and excite our wonder by their keen perceptions of their surroundings. The late Lord Rayleigh used to quote the case of a friend of his who could walk into a room and after listening for a moment to its sound, could give all its dimensions in feet. The sounds that are reflected and used are no doubt feeble. The noises of the feet, of rustling clothes, even of one's breathing, or sounds that come from elsewhere and are reflected in delicate graduations of strength that are perceived by the keen ear of the man who may not use his eyes. Even in the open country, the reflected sounds can be read and interpreted. We know, of course, the rough effects in the changes of sound when in the train we listen to its roar as it passes through a bridge or a station. Or in the motor car, we notice the little variations as we pass, now a hedge, now a row of palings, or a brick wall, or an open space. But the blind man, whose ears have been sharpened by necessity, uses them as we use our eyes. After all, it isn't to be wondered at that when eyes fail, we should use our ears. When we see objects, our brains interpret what our eyes perceive. Light that has been scattered at the surface of many objects before it gets to our eyes is like sound which has been similarly scattered before it gets to our ears. No doubt, the light gives us far more and better information than sound does, but we fall back upon the latter when the former fails.